work and fulfillment. Welcome to Prayer Quest. I'm Father Thomas Dubé. This week, we begin where we left off last time, and you may recall that we were dealing with the consequences, fundamental, basic as you can think of, that flow from what leisure is in human life. And we have taken three of these consequences, and we proceed on with the next one. Boredom is directly related to an incapacity for leisure. Now, let me say a little word about this incapacity question before I make the point. You and I are more or less capable of drinking this reality, the open receptivity to drink reality and be transformed by it. People vary tremendously in their capacity or incapacity for being enriched by the real. Whether it's listening to Mozart or looking at a rose or an orchid, you have experienced yourself how differently people react to one and the same thing. Now, what I'm saying here is boredom is directly related to an incapacity for leisure, an inability to respond to reality, that wonder idea we considered some time ago, an incapacity to be sparked and enriched by the real. Let me use an example from one of my heroes, G.K. Chesterton. He was a man who was just immensely capable of being enriched by reality and responding to it. Chesterton, genius that he was not first class about reminding himself about details of human life, appointments, and he missed trains and all that sort of thing. His wife had to keep him in line about that sort of thing. He had such tremendous ideas in his mind, that is what concerned him. In any event, he missed the train, and I don't think that was rare for Chesterton. He once said, by the way, that the way to catch a train is to miss the one that just preceded it, and they'll be in time for the next one. Anyhow, on this particular day, he missed a train in a country station in England. It was a dark, dull day, probably November, and most people would say, wow, I have to wait in this dingy little place, and maybe it was kind of dirty, you know, not well kept up. And most people would be dismally disappointed that they'd have to spend maybe 2-3 hours, nobody around, dingy little station, nothing to do. They would be bored to death. Not so Chesterton. Chesterton was elated at the opportunity he had to enjoy that little station. Now, most people would say there's nothing to enjoy there. Incapable of leisure. And they're bored to death about it. Now, what Chesterton meant was, I don't remember his specific examples, but I can make them up. I've read a good bit of him, and I think I know his mind pretty well. I'll make up a couple examples which he would agree with, I'm sure. He would say, yep, that's exactly what I mean when I say I'm thrilled to be in this little station for 2 hours, 3 hours, waiting for the next train. What he meant was, suppose the windows weren't very clean, that they hadn't been cleaned maybe for 6 months, and dust had collected and maybe little bits of mud and so on. Chesterton said to himself, now I have the opportunity to enjoy those gorgeous curves of mud. You know, when the rain hits a window and it drips and drains, it will leave curves of different types. And he was just thrilled that he could admire the beauty of those curves. And he's right, most people wouldn't even see the beauty, but it's there. He wasn't making it up. And he meant also, for example, that he had the opportunity to look around the station. And he could look up in the corner of it and admire those cobwebs. Gorgeous. And they are gorgeous. Most of us wouldn't even notice they're there, or if we did notice, we would say, what a messy place this is. Nobody cleans the thing. He was elated to admire that architecture of a cobweb and to be amazed how those fine filaments can hold a very heavy insect. And he could just be wonder-filled at it. He was not bored in the least. He was a man entirely capable of drinking reality. First of all, he would see it. Then he would wonder about it. Then he would enjoy it and be immensely fulfilled through it. Let me give you an example of the same incapacity of leisure. It's not to my credit, but it does make the point. When I was a student studying philosophy, for one of the courses, the ordinary professor was sick or couldn't teach it. I don't recall what the reason was. And a substitute taught it, a fine man, but he didn't know how to teach. He would come in each class. The course was in Latin. And if you could understand Latin, you could read the book easily enough. He would come in, he would open the book, and in a genial manner, he would read the book to us and translate it. Now, I suppose that was a service to some of the students who maybe couldn't translate it too well themselves. But if you could, there's no point really in being in class. And he would comment to some extent about the text. Well, that is not a way to teach, and I haven't changed my mind about that. But if someone had asked me, and if I had a right to express my opinion, if I was bored in that class, I would have had to admit I was. And if the person went on to ask another question, well, why were you bored? In those days, I would have to have said, because that's what I thought, that this man does not really know how to teach. You don't read books to people. You might read something from a book to illustrate a point, but you don't read to them. And I haven't changed my mind about that. But what was wrong in my thinking then was my explanation of why I was bored. I placed it on him. It was mostly on me. I was not mature enough to be excited by all the truth that he read to us. And every sentence that he read was the truth about some mystery of revelation. And if I were really alive, I would have been jumping up and down inside at that truth. But I wasn't very alive. I was incapable to some extent of leisure. Now, of course, I still am incapable. Who of us is fully responsive to all of reality? But at last, at least I think I can say at last, I am a little more capable of it than I was then. So the fourth conclusion that follows from what we have defined as leisure and illustrated at great length last time is that boredom is directly related to an incapacity of leisure. And I say this not to discourage people who would say, well, I'm bored often. I'm bored most of the time. I don't want to discourage people, but we must face reality. I am innerly poor if I'm bored much. And I'm not capable or slightly capable of wonder. I've got a lot of growing as a human person, a lot of growing to do. The fifth conclusion that follows from what we have been saying thus far in our series is that leisure, contemplation, and contemplation is the best example of leisure that we have. It is drinking beauty, divine beauty, delighting, exalting, being enriched. Contemplation is presented in Scripture as the one thing, which in biblical term means one thing, top priority, overriding necessity in human life. Psalm 27, verse 4. The one thing I ask of the Lord, the one thing I seek, namely the most important thing in my life, and notice this is said for everybody, it's not just monks and nuns. The one thing I ask, the one thing I seek, to dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, and to gaze on the beauty of the Lord. That is a perfect example of leisure. It's a perfect definition of contemplation. Gazing on the beauty of the Lord. Now you notice the psalmist says twice to emphasize the point. It's the one thing. It's the top priority. And anybody who admits that a human being is more than a camel or a duck because of spirit, that's the big difference. Anybody who admits that will have to agree with the psalmist that the one thing has to be the enrichment of a human person. We're not just a brick or a bird or a fish. And we've got to be enriched in our capacity to drink reality and be transformed by it. In the New Testament, Jesus himself refers and relates back to this idea of Psalm 27 in that charming account, Martha and Mary. It is found in Luke's Gospel, chapter 10, verses 38 to 42. And I should like to take a pretty good look at this. This little passage, by the way, upsets some people because they're looking at it really superficially. They don't realize what the Lord's saying and they get upset about it. And it bears on the point we're making here perfectly. Luke begins by saying that the Lord was on a journey and he comes to a village and he goes to a house of his special friends, Martha, Mary, and Lazarus. And we can tell elsewhere in the New Testament that they're special friends of the Lord. So he goes down there to that house. And we read in verse 39, speaking of Martha welcoming him to the house, that's verse 38. Then verse 39, she had a sister called Mary who sat down at the Lord's feet and listened to him speaking. Luke is a skillful writer, talented. He makes many points a little subtly. They're clear enough, if you notice, but he doesn't come right out and say something. He wants you to draw that conclusion, which is plain. If one's alive again, one'll see it right away. Notice, she had a sister called Mary who sat down. This is typical of Martha's sister, Mary, that when the Lord shows up, the eternal Word in the flesh, that what she does is put aside everything else. And she sits down and she gives him undivided attention. She had a sister called Mary who sat down at the Lord's feet and listened to him speaking the eternal Word. She had things right. Now, Luke then goes on. Now, Martha, who was distracted with all the serving, said, Martha doesn't understand this thing. Martha is a work first and maybe leisure later. See, I'm not belittling work, nor is the Lord, but it's not number one, as we said last time, I think it was. Now, Martha doesn't understand Mary here. We've got millions of Marthas, by the way, and make them masculine, too. Martha, who was distracted with all the serving, said, Lord, do you not care that my sister is leaving me to do the serving all by myself? And most people by far would say that, or they would think it if they didn't say it. Get busy and get to work and stop listening to the Lord. See, to put it in our terms, stop being at leisure and absorbing divine reality. Put that aside and get to busy with your work. Please tell her to help me. Now, the Lord doesn't agree with Martha. Martha's a very good woman, no doubt. As a matter of fact, she's a saint. But she's got this wrong, and the Lord has to straighten her out. But the Lord answered, Martha, Martha. Notice how much the Lord loves Martha, too. Even though she's wrong, he repeats her name twice. You don't say that, Susan, Susan, unless you really love Susan. But he loves Martha, but she's wrong. Martha, Martha, he said, you worry and fret about so many things, and yet few are needed, indeed only one. There's that biblical one thing. Now notice, the Lord is not criticizing Martha for working. He's not saying it's wrong to work. He worked himself in the carpenter shop, and he worked on the road, and his teaching was work, remember. So he's not complaining about work, but Martha doesn't have things right. And that's the point he's making. You worry and fret about so many things, and our world is full of Marthas, and men as well as women. You worry and fret about so many things, and yet few are needed, indeed only one. That's the biblical overriding necessity. The one thing that is needed is precisely what Mary is doing. And that's the point he makes in his next remark. It is Mary who has chosen the better part. It is not to be taken from her. Notice, Mary's doing something very different. We contrasted already. Work and leisure, they're very different things. We had seven differences. Both are needed in human life, but they're very different. And the Lord is making that very point. Mary has chosen the better part. And we've made that point too in different words, last time especially. It is not to be taken from her. Now, what is the Lord saying? He's not talking about superficially, well, Mary will have to give up sitting on the floor listening to me. He's saying something much more profound than who's going to do up the dishes or who's going to serve the meal first. He's saying something profound, and it is this. Martha, you're worried about all kinds of things that pertain to this world. Good as they are, necessary in a way, but they're not the one thing. And you're concerned about all these things, and you're not concerned about the eternal thing. Remember, leisure is the ultimate eternal livingness in the beatific vision. The Lord's referring to that here. It's the eternal thing. And when he says that what Mary is doing will not be taken from her, he means not that she's going to expire on the floor. He means that what she has begun here on earth in dark faith, she accepted the Lord on his word, which means by faith. Faith is accepting something on the word of a true speaker. Okay. What she's doing on earth, by its very nature, is to be eternal. It begins in dark faith on earth. It continues in eternal clear vision, in seeing and being entranced with Father, Son, and Spirit forever. Whereas you, Martha, are concerned with this worldly activities, which have their place, but you must put first things first. That is what the Lord is saying. That is our fifth conclusion. Leisure and contemplation are the one thing, the top priority in anyone's life, whether one is a monk, a nun, a priest, bishop, or married, single. It's number one for everyone. That leads us to our sixth conclusion that follows from our concept of leisure. Namely, it gives us what we've been talking about, a perspective about the time pressure problem. You have noticed already that in our lineup of this whole series, there's a whole section that deals with pressure, prayer and time pressures. And all of us have experience, if we are trying to live a serious prayer life, of having the opportunity for prayer and ample time for it. And I'm going to talk about that at some length because it is so practical. It is so urgent a need in lay life especially, but also my own life. I have had time pressure problems. I have had to solve them and put first things first. Our Holy Father, Pope John Paul II, once said that his first business is prayer. You know, you would think somebody who has to worry about a whole world and just millions of Catholics, as well as be much concerned about others outside the church, his first business is not the work to be done. His first business is prayer. He knows the Lord's mind, and he's following it. In any event, what we have been saying about leisure gives us a perspective on the time pressure problem, though we will deal with details and pointers toward solution later on. I might make this one point at this moment. Not only must you and I, no matter what our state in life happens to be, not only must we put prayer first. Maybe we don't spend most hours at prayer, but it must have pride of place. But also, people need us to put prayer first. People don't need our professional services first. They do need them, by all means, and we should be top-notch in our profession. But they need the quality of our person more even than they need the actual work. For example, somebody teaching in a classroom or a nurse at a bedside. The pupils in the classroom need a teacher who knows the subject and knows how to put it over and excite their wonder, etc. But they need even more that that teacher be a deeply prayerful man or woman, a beautiful person. That will leave much more lasting impact for a whole lifetime than the quality of teaching spelling or geometry or whatever it happens to be. Important as that professional aspect is, the quality of the person is needed even more. And that goes for parents at home. They not only need to instruct their children verbally, they need even more to instruct them by the very holiness and the beauty of their lives. And that goes for the nurse at the bedside, the administrator in a business or an office. People need our holiness of life much more than they need our service. And that goes for a priest too. If I get up in a parish church and give a homily, or if I teach a class someplace, and supposing I'm saying the right things, well and good and important, and indeed it's important to say the right things, but they need a priest in front of them who's living the Word. I won't comment on how well or not I live the Word. I should be living it perfectly. And that's the point here, that people need, despite all our pressures of work, they need our goodness of person, the radiance of example, saintliness. They need that much more than the work we do in their behalf. The seventh consequence that follows. I'd like to talk about teachers for a moment. And I mean teachers in a classroom, whether it's kindergarten, grade level, junior high, high school, college, university. I'm talking about all teachers professionally, but I'm also talking about mothers and fathers, because they are teachers in the home. And to some extent, we all teach others, even informally. If you have a chat with somebody and you say some things, you're teaching. Maybe the truth, maybe not. Maybe you're talking trivialities, but that's teaching something about what you think trivialities are worth. You think they're important. You're teaching something, happens to be false. But I want to talk, therefore, about teachers. And I'm thinking very much of teachers in the home as well as teachers in our schools and universities. And the point I want to make here is, and it follows from everything we've said this time and last, teachers impart information, of course. Take that for granted. But they must excite wonder in their pupils. And I said a word about this last time, but I want to say much more, because it is crucial. Because in teaching, human beings are being formed for eternity. We're not simply teaching in this five-year-old in kindergarten, somebody who's going to live 70 years or 80 or 90. We're teaching an eternal being. This youngster is an eternal being. And we're forming or deforming, although free will involved too in what a person becomes forever, very much is involved. But nonetheless, teachers have a weighty, weighty burden on them. We're forming eternal beings. Whether it's teaching a baby, psychiatrists say that the first 6 weeks of a baby's life is mightily affected by the mother, the affection she shows or not, the way she deals with the child or not. And so I'm talking about all these ways we teach. And I'm saying that it is not enough to impart information. We must excite wonder. Let's begin at home. Children naturally are full of wonder. That's why they ask so many questions, especially if they're healthy children. A dreadful mistake if parents do not take that beginning wonder and excite it. Wow, there are just 1,000 opportunities of exciting wonder in a child who asks about, is it snowing? Well, take 5 or 10 minutes and explain a snowflake. You might say, I don't know. We'll find out, you see, and excite wonder in the child about a snowflake. It's amazing, a snowflake is. Or a drop of rain, or anything else you want. Teach wonder in the home, and also in school. Now, this goes for university education. It goes for every subject I can think of that we should teach wonder. Not that we say, now wonder about this. Be full of wonder yourself and communicate it to others, even if you're not a professional teacher. I made this point a few years ago in giving what we call a renewal program of 6 weeks to a group of sisters in their 30s. It's about 10 years after first profession, they come back for a renewal period. And I think I was talking about community in the context. In any event, I had made the point about wonder, maybe not at great length as I am right now, and I did the other segment we had some time ago. I was making the point of a teacher teaching wonder in the manner of in which one presents the material. And one of the sisters making the renewal raised her hand in the discussion period, and she shared this with us. She said, you know, so happy at what you said about wonder. I have a custom, she said, in my classroom of setting aside one corner in the front of the room, and I call it a wonder corner. And in September, when the school year begins, one day I bring in something in class, and I explain it to the youngsters. Maybe they were third graders or fifth. They could be university students, adapted to one's level. But anyhow, they were grade school. She said, I bring in something, it might be a seashell maybe. I bring it into class, I explain it, I try to excite their wonder, and then I put it in the wonder corner for that day. Then the next day, I bring in something else, put it in the wonder corner. Then after a few days, I then say to the students, now each one of you must bring in, each one will have one day, and each student brings in something to wonder about, and explain it. You might have to look at an encyclopedia, you might have to ask your parents, you might have to ask somebody, but learn about this and explain how marvelous it is. As we said a few sessions ago, a grain of sand is a marvel. An atom is a marvel. Nobody understands an atom completely. It is so marvelous. And so each student brings in something, explains how marvelous it is, and that goes in the Wonder Corner. And they all take a turn. I thought that was terrific. And that's the way to do it. That's the way mothers ought to operate with their children. Even if they don't have a Wonder Corner, there's just endless opportunities to excite wonder. And notice that all the while this is being done, the person is being enriched. And it's a very short step. It's hardly a step at all from wonder to divine praise. Because God is the architect and the artist of all of them. And that step can be taken with children with no effort at all. And that brings us to our last consequence that follows from what we have been saying about leisure these last few sessions. Contemplation is the number one example of leisure and enrichment. And I should like to return to a text in St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians that we considered, several sessions ago. It's in Ephesians chapter 3, and I think it will now have a still richer meaning for you, where Paul prays before the Father. He kneels before the Father, from whom every family takes its name, spiritual or natural. And he then says, speaking of the breadth and the length and the depth of the love of Christ, there's no limit to it, until you are filled with the utter fullness of God. St. Paul wants his Christians, you and me therefore, everyone, to be filled utterly with God, who is the supreme wonder and the supreme fulfillment of the human person. Until we meet again next time, may your prayer quest prosper.